I'd like to start by thanking both Denny Miller and Stephen Kells and the ESA for the very kind invitation to speak about our experiences on bed bugs from Australia. And so, as I'm from Australia, I better start out with a g'day, folks. So, as an overview of this talk, I'll start by talking about the history of bed bugs, naturally enough focusing on the recent re-emergence. Then I'm going to talk about our four-point strategy that we've undertaken in order to deal with the re-emergence of this public health pest. The four points include recognition. This is where we've attempted to get a better idea of the degree of the resurgence and the economic consequences as a result of the re-emergence. Next, I'll talk about the development of best practice. This is best practice both in terms of eradication of active infestations and the management of potential infestations. Then I'll talk about education of pest controllers, accommodation industry and all stakeholders based on best practice. And finally, I'll talk about some of the research that we've undertaken. So bedbugs in Australia, well, like everywhere else in the world, the bedbugs were spread to our nation by the early European colonists. So Australia was established in 1788 by the Europeans. But leading up to the 20th century, bedbug infestations were very rare and they tended to be mainly associated with the socially disadvantaged. The first inkling for our department, at least, that something funny was going on was in 2003 when we received a specimen which turned out to be a tropical bedbug, and this had never been described before in Australia. Where was it found? It was actually found in a cafe. Now, I'm not sure whether this is actually some sort of yuppie strain that likes a latte with a blood, I don't know, but it's the last place where you think you'd first discover a bedbug, of course. And that we published this, and the title of the paper then was, Has the Tropical Bedbug Invaded Australia? I don't know whether this particular title was prophetic or just plain stupid, because they're well established. And we see, if I can get the mouse going, no I won't, but basically New South Wales, Queensland border, we see a rough overlap of the two species. Then we see the tropical to the north and the common to the south. And we see occasional outbreaks from each species outside the area, but they just tend not to establish. But the significance of having two species for Australia is that the whole country is receptive to bedbugs and undoubtedly contributed to the resurgence in our country. At Westmead Hospital in Sydney, we have a pathology service for the identification of insects of medical importance. In 2004, Marilyn Geary, who's the head of that service and also my partner and is with me today, sitting in the audience, said to me one time, gee, we're getting a lot of bed bugs lately. Oh, that's interesting. So we actually looked through our records, and even then we'd seen a 250% increase in the number of samples submitted to our department. So this prompted a few calls. I rang around some pest control companies, and one pest control company saw that he observed a 700% increase over this period. We contacted our quarantine authority, the Australian Quarantine Inspection Service, and they'd noticed a dramatic increase in terms of inceptions of first call ports since 1999. And so we published this in 2004, and in fact I presented this information at the International Congress of Entomology, which was actually in Australia that year, and I was expecting to see a lot of bedbug talks, and mine was the only one, which was quite surprising. And it's interesting to look back that pest controllers have known about this problem for some time, but it's taken some period before researchers have actually picked up on this issue. In the same year, Sydney's the largest city in Australia and the capital of our state. The council actually commissioned a survey of the backpacking industry in the area and found that 80% of the backpackers within Sydney actually had experienced bedbug infestations. I expect 20% of it were lying, actually. Even back then, some of the managers were saying to me that 35% of their beds had been infested with bedbugs at that time. Since then, I've gone to backpackers where actually 100% of the beds have had bedbugs at some time. Oh dear. And there'd been many stories about pest control failures, suggesting possible resistance, but it was only after we actually collected bedbugs that had been walking on permethrin dust we knew that this was a serious problem, and clearly was a contribution to the resurgence. Now I come to the first strategy that we've implemented, and that's recognition. when I talked about the first paper where we talked about the number of samples that were submitted to our pathology service and the increases recorded by pest control industry, that was actually a very small data set. So in 2006, we conducted a survey of Australian pest managers with the principal aim being to more accurately document the rise of the bedbug re-emergence. There was other things that we also asked about, which I don't have time to go into, such as property types, various pest control, pest management behaviours from treatment types. We asked what insecticides they used, what worked, what failed. We asked whether there was a need for further education and other factors as well. But you don't need to see the fine detail of this slide. But these are the results state by state. And if you look at it across all states, we see pretty much the same thing, an exponential increase in terms of the number of treatments undertaken by professional pest managers. And when we combine all the results, we see that since the year 2000 in Australia, the survey recorded a 4,500% increase in the number of bedbug treatments being undertaken. Of course, a graph like this does hide a lot of information. So we've got this graph again, slightly different scale, but clearly different groups have been affected at different times. And certainly it was a backpacking industry that was affected the worst, by far the worst, and by far the earliest. But since then, we've seen bedbugs spread to more mainstream motels. 2 to 3 years ago, we noticed a tremendous increase in the number of people having experienced bedbugs in their own home, picking it up through business or holidays, etc. And the last 2 years, we've seen a dramatic widening of the infestations into the wider community, into cinemas, and control of bedbugs in cinemas is a shocker. In hospitals, 2 days before I left, there was a headline, "Bedbugs in Kids Ward." I was glad to get out of the country. And we've seen a huge problem of bedbugs in the disadvantaged, and this has really only occurred within the last year. But in this case, we can be talking about massive infestations. And those of you who've got experience with bedbugs, you'll recognise all the spotting, etc., and the number of bedbugs in this. And I'll just run through some slides. But this particular group, as we know, doesn't have the economic capabilities to pay for the control. But often they don't even have the cognitive awareness to even know bedbugs are present. In this particular infestation, if we would have said, maybe 300,000 plus or minus 100,000, we're probably right. This was in his clothes cupboard. This was the end of his bed. And this was directly underneath the end of his bed. So you can see there's just so many bedbugs. That razor blade's almost covered. And it's a major concern for me because often these go not detected. This was detected through a very strange means, which I won't go into, but they're highly infectious. And if you've seen them in a multi-storey dwelling, they'll spread, and we've seen them spread 4 to 5 floors away from the initial source. And I can see that unfortunately, that these groups of people would act as a reservoir for the wider community in the future. The other aspect of recognition is attempt to get the some sort of grasp of the financial impacts of bedbugs and the overall economic burden upon the country. Now, this is very difficult to do. As any of you have worked on bedbugs, getting cooperation from the accommodation industry is very, very difficult. In 2004, we developed an online survey for the accommodation industry, but closed it down after 6 months because of poor response. But what we've been able to do is actually track some infestations within certain dwellings and get some idea of these economic consequences. What we see here is a staff accommodation block attached to one of the major hospitals in Australia, in Sydney. Bedbugs were first detected in May 2003, where they were treated, and they were very poorly treated. And as all of you know, if bedbugs are treated very poorly, it just causes their spread. And what this does is actually track the infestation over time. And you can see that from the initial source, they start to spread. Maybe we see another introduction up the top right. It could be internal spread. Perhaps the doctors and nurses were playing doctors and nurses. I don't know. But we'll continue on. And what do you see? Clear clumping. And all but one of these infestations, there was an adjoining room infested. So we get to May. And by then, 10% of the rooms had experienced bedbugs. And management thought, I think we've got a bit of a problem here. And so they actually got rid of the initial pest controller, had done some treatments, brought in a very good pest controller who inspected every room and treated accordingly. And lo and behold, 20% of the rooms had actually been infested. There's many lessons from this particular case, particularly in terms of poor pest control. One of the questions I often ask the pest control industry in association with this particular example is just how many times do you think bed bugs were introduced into this facility? And you know, I will guess and say once. And the reason why I say once is because despite bed bugs being at record levels, we've never seen bed bugs ever again in this facility since they've been controlled. But if the initial infestation was controlled properly, it would have cost about $300. In the end, it cost about $42,000, and that's actually a minimum cost, or about $600 per room, which is actually pretty cheap. And one reason why it's cheap is because the rooms, even though they were closed for treatment, there was no loss of income to the block because it's a long-term lease. In a very similar situation, a three-star in the City Motel, costs came to $1,500 per room. Of course, are these costs representative of the problem? Well, naturally not. For backpackers, they often do the control themselves. They may even pay somebody $60 per room. They never get control, but they're happy. But five-star motels will pay hell of a lot. They'll close down rooms for 2 weeks or more, and if they think you've got a room for $400 a night, that's a great loss of income. For the homeowner, costs are generally much greater. 99% of the time, if bed bugs are in the homeowner will throw out their bed, they'll throw out the carpet, they'll almost rip off the walls to make sure they got rid of them. And if we go back to the survey that I've just discussed, the survey actually only captured about 2-3% of the industry, and the total number of infestations reported in association with a recent re-emergence is about 10,000. And if we be very conservative with these figures and say that this survey actually represented 10% of the treatments, then this comes to 100,000 infestations since the recent re-emergence. But the thing is, the backpacking industry is largely not represented because they tend not to pay pest managers to do control. And I expect if we were to put backpackers in there, this figure of 100,000 would be doubled, tripled or more. And so if we have a nice round assumption of $1,000 per infestation, which I think is very conservative, then we do the calculations and we come to $100 million. Clearly these are gross conservative figures, but I think this is very important that we get some idea of the degree of the economic burden to the country. And of course, infestations continue. And the other important aspect, as many of you would be aware of, that $1,000 per room is absolutely insignificant in the event of litigation. The second strategy is that of best practice. In 2005, we developed what is a code of practice for the control of bedbug infestations in Australia. The reason why we developed this was because the sheer number of poor pest control, the sheer amount of poor pest control and the high degree of pest control failures. It was actually the first code of practice in Australia for any insect, and actually the first code of practice for bedbugs in the world. And there is actually a working party behind this code of practice, which includes industry representatives, pest controllers, insecticide representatives, academics, and even includes Frank Meeks from Auckland, which many of you know. And combined experiences for the pest managers is roughly around over 4,000 bedbug treatments, so a highly experienced group. And simply the aims of this document, which is fairly detailed, it's actually close to 70 pages now, but the aims is best practice, both in terms of eradication of active infestations, but also management of potential infestations as well. A very important role of this document is education, both of the pest managers, but also the client. We know from discussions on Sunday that bedbug control is not just the dominion of the pest controller, it's a client, it's a cooperative venture, and that's what we emphasise, and we emphasise IPM. It has actually been extremely widely accepted in Australia because it is very consultative. When we first developed this document, we put it out to the public in a draft form, asking for submissions, and every submission that we receive is actually discussed by the working party. If we accept it, then we'll make changes. If we reject it, we actually list all the submissions on the website and actually say why we've rejected it as well. So it's a very open document. And it's actually now been accepted by other pest control associations, including the New Zealand Association and the European Association, the SEPA. And we have said that this document is free, and it's free to everybody. And this is an important point of the document, I believe. And we've actually said to other pest control associations, if you want to take it, you want to use it, feel free. This is an international problem. There's no point us doing best practice if you're not. And it can be downloaded from bedbug.org.au. And most critically of all is this document is evolving based on scientific innovations. And so now we're up to the second edition, which was only released last month. And we're reviewing this document yearly and until the bedbug problem abates, or if it abates. It may be a very long document in years to come. Hope not. And so the third strategy is education. I think this is pretty self-explanatory, but education based on best practice. So I present another number of seminars to pest controllers, housekeeping, environmental health officers, etc. We've certainly produced a number of publications from academic forums to industry forums. Of course, we've got our bedbug website, which includes a code of practice, includes many of our research papers and bedbug fact sheets and some images. We expect they'll expand in due time. Next year, during May, we're going to undertake a full-day training course for the pest control industry, which encompasses both theoretical and practical aspects. So the morning we'll be getting up and talking, to like I'm doing there now, and in the afternoon we'll break up into very small groups of 10 people per group, and we'll actually show how to use steam, how to do inspections, how to apply insecticides. And the curriculum is based on the code of practice, so based on best practice as it stands. For pest managers, they'll be eligible for continuing professional development points, which is a fairly new innovation in Australia. And they will actually be listed on the industry association website. One of the big problems for the accommodation industry, that what they've said to us is, how can we trust a pest controller? Well, I don't know. And there's very few pest controllers I recommend, very few. But at least this should give them some confidence in knowing which one to select. Now we come to research, the fourth part of our strategy in combating this insect. We've undertaken some research in non-chemical control options. This has been largely targeted for the enhancement of the bedbug code of practice, and you'll see major changes in the evolution of this document. So we've undertaken some work on steam, where we've seen holes in the code of practice. To add on to Stephen Kell's talk, one of the big problems with steam is that you can blow bed bugs about without killing them, and so it does require knowledge. And if you think, you'll see in the field, you'll see first instars actually within the exuviae of adults, and you'll see eggs within them. And it doesn't take very much of a breeze to blow these things about, and you can actually spread bed bugs without killing them with steam. Another one is a cryonite. I don't know how many of you have come across this, but this is a device that uses dry ice snow. It's horrendously overpriced, and I think the first two letters probably is a start to fill in the four-letter word that I would suggest for it. It's not very good. It just blows bed bugs around everywhere without killing them. We've, as Harold Harlan mentioned, we undertook some research on black plastic. There's the old classic pesty tail that you can wrap up mattresses that are infested, put them out in the sun, and the thermal energy will heat up the mattress and kill the bed bugs. A couple of years ago, I thought, oh, what if there's any science behind this? It just doesn't make sense when you consider, I don't know whether it's the case in America, but these days we have these mattresses that seem to be about this thick and about 30 kilos, which certainly represents ONH, occupational health and safety issues for pest managers to drag through houses. And so what we did, we tested two mattresses. They're actually my mattresses. One on the left is a thin foam mattress, about yay big, say 3 inches or 10 centimetres, and the one on the right is one of these multi-layered sort of mattresses, which is about this thick, and we put probes in the top and the bottom, and this is what we found. The horizontal black line represents a lethal threshold. The black dots across this region here represent ambient temperature. Temperature got up to 35.6, but you can see the probes on the top, very hot, but underneath, the probes nowhere near reach the thermal threshold of bed bug deaths. So we no longer recommend the use of black plastic for the control of bed bugs. We've undertaken some insecticide efficacy study, which I'll go through quickly, and we've provided many bed bugs for overseas groups, including groups here, and we've provided bed bugs for symbiont detection in Australia. And so our bed bugs have been found with Wolbachia, Gamma Proteobacterium, and also just recently in Ehrlichia. In terms of insecticide efficacy study, just to start out by telling you something about the arsenal of insecticides available in Australia, we've got synthetic pyrethroids, we've got bendiocarb or bendiocarb, I think you call it here, both in a dust and wettable powder. We still have propoxyphen aerosol and we still have pyrimethamphos methyl. One of the first products we tested was a CSI trifluromeron. We exposed first instars to treated surfaces and read them through to adults. We used 1 and 2 mils of product, which is the current registration rates against other insects, and basically the whole thing failed, which is terribly disappointing. It would have been good to have a CSI actually in our arsenal that worked. We've been approached by a number of companies now to test synthetically, to test fabric that's been impregnated with synthetic pyrethroids, and the idea that this would be impregnated during the manufacturing process, but all have been complete failure. Quite interestingly, the president of the company who supplied the chemical was very upset at this and actually said to me that, oh, well, we had these studies done overseas and it worked, but it turned out all the research was actually conducted on susceptible strains. Why would you do insecticide efficacy studies on non-relevant strains? I don't know. In fact, there was a product being marketed throughout Europe that's been withdrawn because of our research. We did some work on tea tree oil, and that was my result, should be left in the tree, similar to Robin Todd's results. And we've done some work with diatomaceous earth dust. We don't have any of the silicates registered for bedbug control in Australia. And diatomaceous earth's got some advantages, which I won't go into. But these are the results. Down the bottom, we can see the control. We can see, I won't run through it, but there's various concentrations of diatomaceous earth. It is very slow acting. The good thing about DE is that it just doesn't break down very quickly, it lasts forever, and resistance is unlikely. This is against adult bed bugs, but it was far more effective against juvenile instars, which we'd expect after the work by Joshua. And I think this is actually a good sign, as we can get reasonable control within one day, and you think that most of the insecticides out there are non-ovicidal, and so we need to reapply for the emerging nymphs. And so we've got the dust out there, that it can actually hit the bed bugs very quickly. So the future, well, no doubt the bed bugs are going to be ongoing. If we put it again to the 4-point strategy recognition, it is important for us to repeat the survey, to monitor the situation, to evolve our strategies accordingly. In terms of our code of practice, we will renew it annually and update it regularly. Education, I mentioned that we will be conducting a bed bug roadshow next year, and of course research, and we're really focusing initially on insecticide efficacy studies. We don't have much in the way of dedicated funding at the moment, mainly industry funding, small amounts, but we're looking to do further work. And there's many acknowledgements again, Benny and Stephen and the ESA for the invitation to speak to you. Marilyn, my partner, has helped me with a lot of these projects. Colleagues from Ecolab, Gary Jones, David Lilly, colleagues John Stenos and Nathan Lowe, who undertook the Indio symbiont detection, and of course our working party behind our code of practice, has contributed tremendously towards the development of our code of practice. And with that, thank you.